Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Nicole Nixon. Vicky Gonzalez is off. Well, it's official. After a back and forth and conflicting public health recommendations in the final weeks and days, booster shots are now available for some Californians. At this time, the booster dose applies to a percentage of those who received the Pfizer vaccine, although Moderna and Johnson & Johnson are also appealing FDA authorization. And those currently eligible for the Pfizer booster shot are considered high risk due to their age, underlying health conditions, or line of work, and received their vaccine 6 to 8 months ago. That's between January and March. For now, the rest will have to wait. To date, roughly 70% of eligible Californians are fully vaccinated, and that goes up to around 78% when including those partially vaccinated. Although it is higher than a majority of states, the case rates are low. The big picture is an average, making it easy to overlook pockets and counties throughout California that are still struggling to encourage people to get vaccinated. Some areas in California are half of the statewide average, with a vaccination rate hovering in the 30 percentile of eligible residents. We are going to dive into all of that today. Yesterday afternoon, CAP Radio Insight host Vicky Gonzalez spoke with state epidemiologist Dr. Erica Pond with California Department of Public Health, also known as CDPH. Dr. Pond says eligible Californians are already receiving their booster shots.
How many Californians who received the Pfizer vaccine are eligible?
You know, I think we are re-looking at some of our numbers related to that, so I don't have that handy. But just to recap who is eligible and who should receive a booster, we really have the most emphasis on those who are over 65 years of age and older, long-term care facility residents, and people who are over the age of 50, between 50 to 64, who have underlying medical conditions, or our communities of color who also are shown to be at increased risk of COVID-19 and serious hospitalizations and death.
So I guess how can people then get their booster shot if they qualify? Can they just like walk into a pharmacy like CVS, or do they have to do something else?
Absolutely. There's a few different ways. One, of course, that we continue to promote and that people can look at is myturn.ca.gov, or we have an 800 number, which is 833-422-4255 to make a booster appointment. Or yes, absolutely, most pharmacies are providing boosters. I've seen a combination, and actually anecdotally this weekend, I know some healthcare workers as well who are eligible as well, who got appointments at pharmacies, and certainly many of people's own healthcare providers. But I'd say pharmacies are one of the best places and probably have the most capacity to give boosters right now.
When going into a pharmacy or a clinic to get your booster shot, what do you need to bring with you to prove that you're actually eligible?
So, you know, I think in general, it's really with age, of course, it's obvious. And I think it's helpful to go ahead and bring your COVID-19 vaccination card, if you still have it, to just have them be able to put down your third dose, which would also have your name and your date of birth. And it's really self-attestation at this point. Again, there are some people really emphasizing who are highest priority to get a booster, who I just mentioned, and then others who are eligible. And it's self-attestation as far as meeting those criteria.
Oh, okay, so essentially an honor system.
Yes, that's right.
You know, when it comes to people who fall in that timeline of 6 to 8 months since their vaccination, but they're not eligible yet, when could that potentially become reality?
Yeah, so it's of course going to vary a bit. I think right now it's only the Pfizer vaccine that has been approved by the FDA for booster doses. And our hope is that Moderna and J&J recipients will also get FDA authorization soon. We haven't heard yet how soon that will be, but certainly those are the other two next steps nationally that need to happen. And then I think, again, over time, I think as there's more data, there is more data every single day about vaccine effectiveness, how long immunity lasts, how we try to look at markers for immunity. So it's all very complex, which is why there's been a lot of discussion at the national level as well amongst, you know, a lot of federal advisors to really try to determine who is absolutely the highest priority, whose immunity may have waned, or who are at most risk for hospitalization or death versus other decreases we might be seeing in infection. But, you know, the most important thing we want people to remember is that we need to get people who are not vaccinated vaccinated, because that is our way out of this pandemic.
Yeah, you can just go back to the beginning of this year, like in January, and even in the early months of 2021, when, you know, there were just these long lines and waits to get a vaccine for your first vaccination. I would imagine this time around with boosters, since the infrastructure is in place, logistically, this is going to be more streamlined.
Yeah, there's a few things that are really important that are different now. One is that there's plenty of vaccine itself. And so early in 2021, when there were those long lines, the vaccine was really trickling in. And actually, in the beginning, Pfizer was the first one approved and only one manufacturer. And over time, that increased. So there's plenty of vaccine. And it's true, the infrastructure has expanded, although we will also point out that there was a peak in our capacity, probably happened last spring and around March or April when we were vaccinating the most people. And there was a lot more stood up as far as what we call mass vaccination clinics. A lot of these big, you know, stadiums that set up mass vaccines and other places. And those are not necessarily happening again now. But again, we have plenty of vaccine. There's a lot more pharmacies and smaller providers that have vaccines now. We have definitely, you know, thousands more of providers than we did in April that are smaller providers, again, where people can get vaccines. So we don't have the same kind of capacity stood up we had last spring, but there are plenty of places, again, pharmacies, other smaller providers that weren't able to give vaccine early last year when we were having those long lines.
And there's also the reality that those who are in most need of the vaccine have challenges with accessibility. Maybe they can't actually go to a hospital as easily as other people, or even walk into a pharmacy. How will you reach those individuals that really could use the booster shot?
So as far as those individuals looking, they can certainly go to myturn.ca.gov or call that number, 833-422-4255. And actually, we do have options there for mobile vaccination. So those are some ways. And then certainly some healthcare systems or healthcare providers are also potentially providing those resources as well to help people who have difficulty with access. And then there's a lot of partnerships happening with the long-term care facilities to, again, have vaccination providers coming into those long-term care facilities and being able to vaccinate many of those high-risk people all at once.
Some immunocompromised people in California actually started receiving boosters last month, I believe in mid-August. I mean, if you just could explain who these people are and why they qualified prior to this emergency approval from the FDA.
Sure. So people who's, and there was a subtle difference there as far as what was approved. And so people whose immune systems are immunocompromised may not have mounted as strong of a response even in the very beginning after two doses and needed that third dose. And so that's one of the distinctions versus what we call waning immunity, which is over time, maybe your immune response needs a little boost to do better. So those people really needed an additional dose. And what's interesting is less than half of the people who we estimated were eligible who are immunocompromised have gotten those boosters. So we're still trying to work with healthcare providers and others to make sure the word gets out and that that population also gets their boosters. It's people whose immune systems, you know, whether it's from cancer treatment or medicines they take every day for immunosuppression, transplant patients, people like that who, again, their overall immune system is down either because they can't fight infections themselves or they're taking medications that suppress their immune system are the ones that are eligible.
There's also studies looking into the safety of mixing vaccines. You know, if you had Pfizer, you maybe get a Moderna or a Johnson & Johnson. I'm just curious, as those studies and that research is being done, has that been done in the past with other vaccines?
Well, with many childhood vaccines, if they were using the same platform, it wasn't as big of a concern as far as using different manufacturers with a similar platform. But I think a lot of the studies that are happening with this, what we call mix and match, are happening in other countries, and we're hoping to see more of that soon. So there isn't as much precedent for especially mixing and matching different what we call platforms. So, for example, the mRNA vaccines are different than adenovirus vector vaccines. And while these vaccines have been, both those platforms have been studied for decades, these are the first times they've been clinically licensed. And so being able to see the mix and match data will be really helpful. And we do hope some of that will be forthcoming soon.
Public health officials argue that, you know, arguably the more important hurdle to all of this is getting those unvaccinated vaccinated. And you talked about that in the beginning of our conversation. And so even though California overall is doing better than the majority of states in vaccination rates and COVID cases, I mean, when you really zoom into pockets and counties, that's not necessarily the case. I mean, there are some pockets where just a third of eligible residents are vaccinated. I mean, would you agree this is the more important challenge? And I guess, do boosters factor into this or help in any way?
Absolutely, there are pockets, both in certain larger communities and within communities where our vaccination rates are low, as you're mentioning. And that is the most important at this point as far as getting us out of this pandemic. So the most important as far as decreasing transmission is getting those individuals who have not yet been vaccinated. And I think you've probably seen some of the national commentary as well. We don't think we can boost our way out of this pandemic. We really do need to get people who have not been vaccinated. So I think a lot of it is really making sure we can get questions answered. There's so much misinformation out there, and just trying to have trusted people in the community who can provide that information, get those questions answered, and increase vaccine confidence is really what we need to continue to do. And then, of course, you know, what we're anxiously awaiting is for children's vaccines to be approved as well. And that will really help with another proportion of our population. Kids under 12 make up about 15% of our population.
That was actually going to be my next question. I mean, for families closely following when children under 12 will be eligible, I mean, what's the latest on that? I know it can be almost like checking headlines daily and articles daily to see if there's any new developments.
Sure. Over the weekend, I understand that the Pfizer manufacturer said that they would be submitting their data very, very soon to the FDA for approval of 5 to 11-year-olds, and that they are reporting that their data does show safe and effective vaccines for 5 to 11-year-olds. So we're really hoping that does happen very soon, and it will take usually a few weeks, but many people are projecting, you know, hopefully by November is when we'll see 5 to 11-year-old vaccines approved. So we're all crossing our fingers on that.
Finally, for someone who's just planning to get their booster shot, should they be aware of any different side effects, or should they just kind of plan for things to go the way they went earlier this year?
Yeah, I think the data I have seen shows that it could be similar to the side effects seen, you know, with the first or second doses, and certainly side effects are more common from the second dose and similar for the third dose. But beyond that, there's no other separate advice, just to be prepared that, you know, you might be have a little bit of tiredness, maybe some low grade temperatures, some muscle aches for the next day or so, and just certainly some arm soreness, and that is normal. And then it generally passes within a day or so, but nothing more unusual than what happened with the second doses.
Thank you very much, Dr. Pan.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
That was state epidemiologist Dr. Erica Pan with California Department of Public Health speaking with CAP Radio Insight host Vicky Gonzalez, breaking down booster shots for eligible Californians who received the Pfizer vaccine. Their conversation was recorded yesterday afternoon. Up next, is wildfire smoke becoming more of a problem in your area? A California NPR investigation breaks it down by zip code, and the Sacramento area is ranking uncomfortably high on that list. You can join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Nicole Nixon, in for Vicky Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm Nicole Nixon, filling in for Vicky Gonzalez. When talking about wildfires and the impacts the smoke has on people's health, we tend to focus on how it affects Californians. But the smoke and its hazards is far-reaching. Back in July, we saw many news stories that the smoke was affecting states across the U.S. all the way to the East Coast. And if you have loved ones in other states, they may have complained to you about it. Reporters from our NPR sister stations throughout California combed through 10 years of data from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, to learn more about just how far-reaching the smoke is. They focused on specific zip codes that experience the most unhealthy air quality due to wildfire smoke. Joining us now to talk about their investigation are data reporter Allison Saldana with NPR's California Newsroom and KQED reporter Farida Javala Romero. Welcome to Insight.
Hi.
Thank you. Hi.
So I want to start off by asking each of you, why did you want to focus on the impacts of wildfire smoke? Allison?
Yeah, well, that's just it. We know that wildfires in recent years have been burning hotter, faster, and stronger than ever before, and this is a fairly new phenomenon. Researchers are still trying to understand what are the impacts of this exposure to smoke on human health. And it's going to be a while before they can tell us exactly what's going on, but the urgency of the situation calls for raising awareness and action, because wildfires are more dangerous than regular fine particulates in the air. Not only is it made of the most dangerous air pollutant, it's possibly much worse, as the research is starting to show. So that has been our goal, is knowing what we do right now. We wanted to understand how much of this toxic smoke residents across the U.S. have been exposed to over the years until now.
Well, how did you go about this project? I guess tell us more about what exactly you found here.
So we partnered with Stanford University's Environmental Change and Human Outcomes Lab to get the data on smoke exposure at the zip code level so that it resonates more with everyday people like you and me. And because right now, the way we think about wildfires is something that happens in the forest or something that happens far away from the urban areas. And so what the researchers at Stanford did was they took the satellite images of smoke exposure over the Earth, and which has been recorded for every day for over a decade now, and they placed them onto zip codes for the entire U.S. We then got that data and put that in, we had that in a spreadsheet. We started looking at it to compare it over the years, and we found it best, given that smoke moves through the air and it's kind of unpredictable in the way it moves depending on weather conditions, we grouped a few years so that we can understand what has been the change over two different time periods.
Well, what stood out to you in kind of crunching these numbers and looking at the images?
I think one of the most stark revelations was just the fact that it's not just a Northern California problem. It's not just something in the Central Valley. This is pretty much across California that you're seeing a tremendous rise in the exposure to smoke for residents. And it's not even just California, because it's happening across the U.S. as well, as our research will show you. The exposure has increased in Southern California specifically from maybe a week to now over a month on average for the last 5 years.
Farida, I want to bring you in here. What stood out to you?
Well, I think for me, it was just shocking to see just how many days people may be breathing smoke in some parts of our state now. And, you know, people are trying to deal with it, changing the way they go about their day and trying to protect their kids and their health. But there's only so much you can do when the air around you is, you know, frequently unhealthy.
Right. So you found the smokiest place in California is a town called Willows. So, and you went there, Farida, what was the reaction, you know, about finding out that they've seen 3 months of smoke on average in recent years?
Yeah, so Willows is about 100 miles north of Sacramento. It's the county seat of Glenn County. It's a big agricultural region. And people really felt the smoke, especially last year, you know, when we had record-setting wildfires. And then in 2018, when the campfire burned the nearby town of Paradise in that part of the Sacramento Valley, and people were seeing, you know, ash raining down, huge plumes of smoke as the fire ravaged Paradise, you know. And so the smoke has been getting trapped there a bunch, in part of because of the geography of the area. And, you know, people told me they'd seen smoke in the region before. There's some agricultural burning that goes on after the rice harvest there, for example. And there've been wildfires in the region before, but it's never been quite like this. And it's really changing life there.
Yeah. Can you talk about that a little bit more? What kinds of things have changed for people in their everyday lives?
Yeah. So, I mean, just recently, schools in Willows have canceled recess and sports practices outdoors. Sometimes it's a very last minute thing where there's a huge scramble, you know, by school administrators and parents and students when they try to change the location of football games, for example, to protect students' health. And school administrators are monitoring air quality reports almost religiously, you know, every morning to see what kind of day everyone's going to have. I spoke with Stacy Lancey, who was born and raised in Willows. She's a third grade teacher and has she has two teen sons. One of them is a student at Willows High. And I spoke with her at one of the high school football games on a day when the air quality was okay.
It's affecting, you know, air quality as far as like kids going out to recess, playing sports, and kind of like an overall health of like, we don't know why we're having headaches and runny noses.
Allison, you focused on San Diego. What does the investigation show about smoke exposure there?
Well, what we found was that smoke exposure in San Diego has tripled from about a week on average at the start of 2009 to 2013. We were looking at maybe a week of exposure in that area. And now it's over a month. So it's literally tripled. And with that, we can also we took a look at prescriptions for asthma medications, looking at Medicare data. And we found that that has risen by nearly 20%. Now, that happened between 2013 and 2018. And over 5 years, you see a 20% jump. Wow. It could be other reasons that could have led to that. But the fact of the matter is that this is happening alongside this tripling in the exposure to wildfire smoke. And we do know for a fact that smoke aggravates heart and lung conditions. So, I mean, this is all very concerning.
Yeah, Allison, can you tell us a little bit more about how many more days people are breathing in wildfire smoke compared to past decades?
So we have this data for the last decade or so, and where you live across the country, it really depends on how much smoke you are exposed to based on that. What we can sort of see from the data is that the Midwest and pretty much across the US, let's start off with that, everyone's breathing in more smoke than they were less than a decade ago. And the only exceptions to that may be the Midwest, although they were already recording pretty high number of days of smoke exposure, but there has been some improvement. And Florida. And if you look closer at what's going on in the Midwest, as the researchers at Stanford did, you can sort of see that while there are fewer days, the density of smoke has actually increased in those parts. So it's not that great either. And while Florida has seen some improvement, and you know that it's the data sort of points to the fact that prescribed burns may be working there, some of those gains have been outdone by the sugarcane burning, as you can see in the counties that have sugarcane farms, that smoke exposure has risen tremendously.
Well, you also found that smoke travels completely across the country, even if it's not visible to your naked eye. What can either of you tell us about that?
Yeah. So scientists are still trying to understand and predict how smoke moves through the air. There's not a lot of definite language around how we can explain that. But what we do know is that as it travels greater distances, it moves higher into the sky, so it's at a greater altitude. But, I mean, at the end of the day, there is still the presence of smoke in the air, and you're still exposed to it. And the research shows that smoke from wildfires could be more dangerous than car exhaust fumes in some cases, as some new research shows. And even though it's not visible to the naked eye, it's still very much a concern for human health.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're talking with data reporter Allison Saldana with NPR's California Newsroom and KQED reporter Farida Javala Romero about their investigation into just how far-reaching wildfire smoke is and how it's affecting everyday lives. Farida, headaches and runny noses have been linked to wildfire smoke. What other health problems are people worried about?
Right. So you mentioned headaches and runny noses. That's exactly what Willow's teacher, Stacey Lancey, was talking about in the last cut we heard. So this is a problem, like Allison was saying, of, you know, having these mega fires and breathing too much wildfire smoke. It's kind of a new phenomena. And because, you know, these mega fires we've been seeing now more frequently with a warming we're seeing those with a warming climate. And so we don't know much yet about the long-term sort of cumulative impacts of wildfire smoke, what happens to us when we breathe a lot of smoke year after year after year. But we do know people with lung and heart conditions are most at risk. And we can definitely see some short-term health impacts in everyone else. I spoke with Brett Brown, who's a physician assistant at the Willows Hospital's family clinic. And, you know, in these small rural towns, a physician assistant like Brett will, you know, regularly treat and diagnose patients. And he says, you know, he sees them complaining of longer asthma attacks, intense migraines, and just a lot of stress. Here's Brown.
There's always somebody who says something about, well, because of the smoke, insert, you know, problem here, whether it's, you know, I haven't been able to breathe as well because my allergies are so bad, or I haven't been able to see my mom and dad, you know, because of COVID, and now I can't even go outside, so my mental health is so much worse.
He also said that the smoke is just worsening, you know, symptoms on people that are normally healthy.
It's been affecting a lot of our patients around here with asthma or COPD. People who normally don't get really sick are having longer and longer episodes of asthma after a cold, or just coming and complaining of terrible headaches. If they usually have migraines, they're worse.
Farida, can you talk a little bit about the mental health struggles? I mean, when we're inside, when we're in a pandemic, being told to stay inside as much as possible, just, I guess, talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think it's the isolation that people are feeling when the air quality is so bad inside. They're supposed to stay inside more if they can. At the same time that we're still going through this pandemic, and some folks may not be able to see some relatives to try to protect them from COVID-19, or if they're quarantining. And then on top of that, not being able to go outside as much as you want, or be able to do the things you like, you know, when you live in an area like Willows, where you have the Sierra Nevada on one side and the coastal range on the other, and people live there to go hiking and whitewater rafting and running outside. And so when you can't do that, it just adds to the stress, you know, and the feeling that things are out of your control, you know, and that, yeah, and the isolation.
Well, kids are being told to stay inside more for recess, but health-wise, how does smoke affect children and seniors?
Yeah, so we know children are also especially at risk. And I say this, you know, this is one of the things that worries me the most as a mom of two young kids, because, you know, they're more at risk because their lungs are still developing. And so I spoke, and also for people who you mentioned, like seniors, people who have lung and heart conditions, like I mentioned, I spoke with one man who lives in Willows. He'd lived there for like more than two decades. He's a Vietnam veteran, and he can't go outside because he has this, you know, chronic lung condition, and to try to protect his health. And so he just feels like he's trapped inside his house whenever it's hazy outside. But others, of course, you know, they can't be indoors because of their jobs, like farmers. And so I spoke with a dairy farmer. His name is Tim Pedroso, who has owned his farm for a really long time near Willows. And he told me the smoke and the air pollution the smoke brings are making the area really, really hard to live in.
We're probably going to move out of the area because we're kind of, we're exhausted having to go through so many years of smoke.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that's something I heard a couple of times from folks. And so some are considering leaving. Those that are definitely stay, you know, want to stay, I heard a lot about how people want, they want solutions. They want better forest management, solutions to climate change so that these fires don't burn so intensely and emit so much smoke. And it's also important to mention that, you know, not every day with smoke in our data means terrible air quality for the reasons that Allison was also mentioning, because the smoke might be light or not at the ground level, but it does point to worsening air pollution. And we saw that, you know, air pollution becoming worse and worse in the EPA's data for Willows, for sure.
Well, we just got a listener email from Reno that says they actually have to cancel school because of wildfire smoke sometimes, because the schools are not equipped to capture that particulate matter when the kids do go to school. And it's not just people who are being affected by the smoke. Farida, how does this affect Tim's, who we heard from earlier, his farm?
Yeah, so Tim Pedroso is a third generation dairy farmer, and he does grasslands. You know, he just, like, his cows are constantly outside, you know, munching on grass. And so what Tim believes is that the couple of years recently where they've seen longer periods with smoke and air pollution, that that made his cows more susceptible for pink eye infections, which can be really painful in livestock. And he said he treated and treated, but it just wouldn't go away, you know, and one cow actually lost her eye. And so, but the thing is, when I spoke about it with veterinarians, they said that the smoke irritates animals or people's eyes and just makes them more susceptible to infections like pink eye. But there's also, they have the same problems that we see in humans as well, right? Like they can have decreased lung capacity, and they can't breathe as well. And I mean, it's just, I think, you know, because these animals are outside more, you know, they definitely feel it.
Well, Tim mentioned, you know, maybe moving out of the area. Allison, from the data you're looking at, would moving out of California provide some relief for him?
I would have, I don't really think so. I mean, perhaps a little bit, but not a lot, because from what we can gather from what the data show is that the exposure to wildfire smoke is increasing across the US. And if I understand correctly, Tim was thinking about moving to the Midwest. And as I mentioned earlier, there has been some slight improvement in the number of days that residents are exposed to smoke there, but the density is actually increasing because of California's wildfires. So it's a little depressing, but yeah, I think the only way forward is to address this with policy change and intervention. So yeah.
Allison and Farida, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's great.
That's data reporter Allison Saldana with NPR's California Newsroom and KQED reporter Farida Javala Romero. You can find a link to their reporting on our website, capradio.org. Still ahead, it's one of Sacramento's treasures. Now, a new plan has emerged to move the Sacramento Zoo to Elk Grove. Up next, why Elk Grove, and why hasn't Sacramento been able to find a viable solution? You can join the conversation too. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Nicole Nixon, filling in for Vicky Gonzalez. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Nicole Nixon, in for Vicky Gonzalez. Each year, about 500,000 people visit the Sacramento Zoo. According to the zoo, it's the number one ticketed attraction in the city. For years, the zoo, as well as many of its patrons, have been calling for the 15-acre site to be improved, upgraded, or even moved to another location in order to better accommodate visitors and exhibits. Those calls grew louder when it was announced the Sacramento Kings were going to build a new arena downtown, leaving Sleep Train Arena empty. But since then, that site has been claimed by a medical university. So what now? Late last week, the zoo and the city of Elk Grove announced they are in exclusive talks to move the zoo to a huge parcel of land just off Highway 99 and Camera Road, more than quadrupling the land it currently sits on in Sacramento's Land Park. While this would make the city of Elk Grove and the zoo happy, some question why Sacramento couldn't find a space for the zoo within its city limits. Lots to discuss, and we have all the key stakeholders here: Elk Grove Mayor Bobby Singh Allen, Sacramento Council Member Katie Valenzuela, and President of the Sacramento Zoological Board of Trustees, Elizabeth Stallard. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Nicole. Pleasure to join.
So, good morning. Elizabeth, can you detail for our listeners exactly why the Sacramento Zoo needs an upgrade?
For the animals. That's the easiest way I can answer that question. We've known for quite some time that the current size, our 14.7 acres, is not enough to provide our animals with the level of care that's increasingly being expected to be an accredited member of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. And so while our animals receive exceptional care, as many in our community have seen over time, we've lost a number of the animals that people came to love to go see at the Sacramento Zoo simply because we couldn't meet the space and other requirements to provide them with the best possible home.
And the zoo's accreditation factors into this. What does that mean? Is that a space issue as well?
Well, one of the things that our accreditation process will look at is whether or not we're providing appropriate homes for our animals. And those standards include standards with respect to the amount of space that a given habitat has. Certain animals have certain minimum expectations of space that the AZA believes they need in order to provide appropriate care, husbandry, and to give them a good environment in which to live.
And so
necessarily, when we don't have that space, we can't meet those expectations.
The AZA is the Association of Zoological Accreditation or something like that?
The Association of Zoos and Aquariums.
Zoos and Aquariums. Okay. Well, how long has the Sacramento Zoo been looking to move? Like, would an upgrade of this existing land and exhibits be enough to maintain the accreditation, or do you need way more space?
We need way more space.
Okay.
And we have been looking at relocation in various forms for decades. We've known that this is an issue for some time, and we've been very strongly pursuing it over the past 4 years, which led us to the exciting news we were able to share last week.
Councilmember Valenzuela, you have been working on this for a long time. The zoo is in your district. Why couldn't Sacramento find a new home for the zoo?
Thanks for that question. And when I came into office about 9 months ago and sat down with the zoo, understood the issue. I mean, it broke my heart that they couldn't stay in Land Park, but I was pretty committed to figuring out what the status was of other potential spots in Sacramento. The simple matter is we don't have a lot of big empty land in the city of Sacramento that's not already owned by somebody or doesn't have plans already in motion. So the sites that were identified, there were three in a study just last year, and a lot of them were ruled out for one reason or another. You know, the Bingaloni site wasn't great for the animals. The arena site, as you mentioned, got used for the hospital. There's still land there, but since the Kings donated so much land to the hospital, we probably have to pay for it. And we didn't know how we would do that. Similar with the North Natomas Regional Park. We just didn't know how we could finance it. I know Mayor Pro Tem Ashby tried a few different things over the last couple of years to figure that out and just kept striking out. So it really was a matter of there didn't seem to be an option. And actually, I have here on my desk in City Hall a post-it note from the last call, which was just a couple weeks ago, where we were discussing other ideas, approaching the county, approaching different stakeholders that had potential big parcels of land nearby to see if that would work. So we really were just out of options, as far as I was told by city staff a couple weeks ago.
Is the city happy with the possibility of this zoo moving to Elk Grove? Like, will there be any last-ditch efforts to keep it?
I know the mayor wants to have an item on an upcoming council meeting so we can discuss if there's any other options we can put on the table. But honestly, as I've told Liz and others before, this has always been about what's best for the animals. I mean, it breaks my heart. There's so much sentimental attachment to the zoo. I mean, the first time I went on an after-hour tour with Jason and our interns, it was magical is the word that I can describe. I mean, we were helping feed giraffes and petting neocopies and, you know, doing things that just was so incredible. I love the zoo, but, you know, I think if we just can't find a spot for it here, I think relocating close by is preferable to us losing the animals and potentially losing the zoo entirely.
Well, Mayor Singh Allen, Bobby Singh Allen, I want to bring you in here. Can you describe for our listeners where the proposed zoo would be located and why there?
Great. Thank you for the question. And to answer some part of your earlier question, we have the space to accommodate the zoo's needs and most importantly, the animals, because ultimately it is about the animals. And so we have identified a 60-acre parcel, which is located right off of 99. Easy access for the entire region. So we see this as a great opportunity for the animals, but more importantly, the region. It is just a few miles south of the current location. And with this expansive 60-acre parcel, we can reaffirm our commitment not only to the animals, but conservation, and also as an educational hub as well.
Can you talk about, at least as much as you can, when the idea was hatched to move the zoo to Elk Grove and how this idea came about?
So, you know, to be honest, to be fully transparent, we are in the infancy of this. So as excited as I am, we want to be very transparent and open in the process. The zoo did approach the city earlier this summer. Because, you know, as Councilwoman Valenzuela indicated, and as well as Liz indicated earlier, that the options were running out in the city of Sacramento in terms of identifying potential land sites. And so we were approached and we had preliminary discussions, and we were at a place where we were able to identify a location, most importantly. It's great to have those discussions, but without having a sizable parcel of land, we would not be able to pursue this. So while we are in our infancy of this, we have entered into an exclusive negotiating agreement, which will allow the City of Elk Grove and the Sacramento Zoological Society to really work through the next 6 months and conduct a feasibility study and to see if a partnership is doable. So while we're hopeful, I want to just be measured in our expectations while I'm excited for the city and most importantly for the region and the animals. I want to make sure that we do our due diligence as a city with the Zoological Society over the next 6 months.
So this is, like as you mentioned, a 6 month sort of viability study. What still needs to happen to make it a reality? And what could the economic benefit to the city of Elk Grove be?
I mean, you know, as someone who also sits on the Visit California Board of Directors, obviously this would be a tremendous win for the region as an economic development driver. This would be a signature tourism destination, not only for the city, but of course for the entire region. The entire region benefits. Just like the world famous San Diego Zoo, people go to the city of San Diego, but they also enjoy the surrounding communities, much like the San Diego Wild Animal Park, which is located in Escondido, but it still has the signature name associated with it because the space is available. So of course, this is an excellent economic driving force for the city, but more importantly for the region. The next 6 months will be a series of workshops and studies and really exploring how this would be financed. So these are a series of meetings with the City of Elk Grove and all of our stakeholders, as well as the Zoological Society. So that will be outlined over the next several months. And I want to be very transparent with our community and be able to share the information along the way. And I know that those are the shared goals with the Zoological Society. And that's why we did announce this exclusive negotiating agreement, so that we would be transparent from the onset of these discussions.
I want to ask this question for all of you here. Mayor Steinberg last week said in a statement that while Sacramento has a lot of priorities right now, the zoo remains one of them and that he will continue to work to find a solution for the zoo's expansion in Sacramento. Can each of you give us your thoughts on that, or has that ship sailed?
You know, Mayor Steinberg is a dear friend. I've known him since, I think, 1993 when he first joined the city council. I think it's the responsibility of both cities to do our due diligence. And as a great mayor of Sacramento, he's doing his due diligence. And so having a public meeting and vetting all of the various issues that are priorities for the city of Sacramento, that's the responsible thing to do, not only as mayor, but the entire city, to not only reaffirm their priorities, but how the various projects are going to be financed and be realistic in terms of an outlook of what are the options for the zoo realistically, because the clock is ticking for the animals. And to be able to identify a location and move forward as soon as possible is the right thing to do for these animals, and also bring back some of those animals that we so love and lost. So I applaud the mayor and the council for their efforts to do their due diligence. Again, so we want to be responsible civic members.
Council Member Valenzuela, I want to have you respond to that statement by the mayor, and also ask you, we got a listener question about the Land Park golf course. Why not, you know, about the revenue from the golf course, and maybe why not use that land to expand the zoo?
Yeah, I mean, to answer the second part first, I mean, it's my understanding that the way the land for Land Park was given to us really precludes us from making big moves like that. So, you know, obviously, if there's an option there and if there's a community willingness, I mean, my thing, and Liz can attest to this from the zoo, has always been like, I just want to figure out a way to make this happen. So I applaud that the mayor is going to agendize this soon. I think there's a lot of questions in the community, like the one you just fielded, that we need to be able to answer in public to make sure everybody knows what's going on. But, you know, really appreciate what the City of Elk Grove is doing. And as Mayor Singh Allen said, you know, continuing to do our work to make sure we exhaust every potential option, but in the end, making sure we move quickly and in the best interest of the animals.
Quick follow up for you. If the zoo does leave Land Park, what would or could take its place?
Well, my goodness, have I gotten a lot of emails on that subject in the last few days. So people are very excited to talk about what they'd like to see there. Things from a botanical garden to maybe senior housing, to maybe, you know, an expanded play area, an adventure playground. Folks are really excited to brainstorm, I think. Obviously, while they're sad the zoo is going to leave, I think there's a lot of potential for that site if and when they do leave, to make that a really great community resource. So we're planning on working with the mayor and my colleagues to do some good engagement in the community when we know that timeline and if and when it's going to happen for the zoo.
Elizabeth, what can the zoo do with a 50-acre piece of land? What's the vision for that?
We can do more and we can do better. As Mayor Singh Allen noted, we're very early in this process. For those of you who've been following our prior efforts at looking at a relocated larger site, you know we have explored larger habitats and different kinds of habitats that we simply haven't been able to provide in our current 14.7-acre space. But the reality is we can do better for the animals. We can ensure that we meet animal husbandry standards, that we meet the expectations for what this community wants to see, and also what our animals need in order to live the best lives they can within our zoological park.
Really quick follow-up for you, just in 30 seconds, Mayor Singh Allen. Elk Grove also has a casino planned for that Highway 99 corridor just up the road from the zoo proposed site. If the city adds a zoo in the vicinity, can Elk Grove handle all of that traffic?
Absolutely. We will conduct thorough traffic studies, and we absolutely would have the infrastructure in place. That would be part of our due diligence and responsibility to the greater region.
That's Elk Grove.
I could chime in on that too.
Oh yeah,
Nicole,
go ahead.
I just want to say that now that Elk Grove is officially back with Regional Transit, of which I'm honored to serve on the board for,
yes,
you know, one of the things that we'd obviously are looking for is expanding things like light rail and other service to Elk Grove so that our region can be better connected without all the car traffic.
No,
the
yes, thank you for bringing that up, Councilwoman Valenzuela. Excellent point.
That is Elk Grove Mayor Bobby Singh Allen, Sacramento Council Member Katie Valenzuela, and President of the Sacramento Zoological Board of Trustees, Elizabeth Stallard. Thank you all for sharing your perspectives, and we look forward to having you back in maybe 6 months.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Insight for today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcasts on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to producer Cynthia Lopez and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief of content. I'm Nicole Nixon. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you right back here tomorrow.